Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Today on Change Surfer Radio, we're listening to a speech by Eliezer Yudkowsky that he gave at the Transvision Conference on June 28th at Yale University. And his speech was about his theory of fun, which I think is actually kind of a fun topic. Eliezer is a computer scientist who does research at the Singularity Institute for Artificial Intelligence. After that, you'll listen to a short essay that I wrote recently in response to the Canadian decision to legalize gay marriage, and a bioethicist in Canada who has been arguing against gay marriage, and I argue for it and for some additional reforms in marriage law. So stay tuned for both of those. Coming up next, Eliezer Yudkowsky. By the way, some of the bumps and noises that you hear in the background of the talk at the beginning are a film crew setting up to tape his talk. So they go away after a while.
I once heard a friend of mine by the name of Lionel talking to a newcomer to transhumanism. And this person had remarked that he wasn't afraid of dying. And Lionel said, well, you hear a lot about overcoming your fear of death, but how many people have tried to overcome their fear of living forever? As transhumanists, I expect that most of us at some point have had to deal with the rationalizations that people develop to suppress their fear of death, the idea that death gives meaning to life and other comforting lies. Personally, I do believe that the fear of death should be counted as a personal flaw. Choosing to live does not require that I be afraid to die. It requires only that I value life. But resolving that philosophical question is not an urgent matter. We can temporarily agree to disagree upon it. The important thing is making sure we have at least a billion years in which to argue about it. Now, living for a billion years is a scary thought. It's not as scary as the thought of living forever, which may or may not be permitted by physical law, but even a mere 1,000 years is a scary thought if you really think about what that would mean for you as a person. Even if you keep all the neurons in the brain alive, the human mind is not designed to handle 1,000 years of memories. You cannot stay a child for even so much as 1,000 years. You must, in that time, at least begin to grow up. But if life is a good thing, should we get scared at the prospect of a huge amount of life? What distinguishes transhumanism as a philosophy is that it wholeheartedly embraces the goal of success instead of making excuses for failure. There are many philosophical explanations for why life must suck in order to be meaningful. Why all the pain and death and catastrophe and the minor annoyances that drain your life force are somehow necessary. Okay, all the standard excuses have a strained, forced quality to them, like a theory stretched to explain evidence that just doesn't fit. Now, transhumanism just says, this sucks, let's fix it. That's all. It doesn't need to be any more complicated than that. Life is better than death. Health is better than sickness. Happiness is better than pain. Knowledge is better than ignorance. And when you see something wrong, you don't rationalize it, you fix it. This is all very straightforward, so what's so special about transhumanism? Actually, there's nothing special about transhumanism. Presently, most other philosophies have a special additional clause that causes them to react oddly to advanced technologies, as if, for example, anything that involves genes is scary. There's the possibly apocryphal story about the person who was warned not to eat a tomato because it has genes in it. In transhumanism, this special yuck reaction is missing, and such technologies are just an ordinary part of the natural universe. Since this is the case, if you can use tissue screening to save 4-year-old Zain Hashmi's life, that was a recent case in Britain, or if you can use golden wheat to prevent vitamin A deficiency, why on earth wouldn't you? Why not? This choice does not require a special enthusiasm for technology, only that the usual sense of future shock be missing. Typically, people encountering transhumanism for the first time assume that while these people are a bit different, what's different about them? They must love technology. It's not about loving technology. It's just that the usual yuck reaction is missing and the ordinary philosophy of good means to good ends takes over. Similarly, ordinary transhumanist philosophies will say that life extension is good up to age 80 or whatever. But if you talk about living to the age of 200, suddenly there's a special reaction of surprise, future shock, because the philosopher hasn't considered that possibility before. While a transhumanist will just say, sure, life extension to 80 is good, life extension to 200 is better, life extension to 1,000 is better yet, and so on. It does not require a special drive toward immortality to say this. It's just self-consistency. Wanting to live to be 1,000 is not a special and unusual desire that needs explaining. It's just ordinary common sense after the future shock has been stripped out. So transhumanism is just the philosophy that says that life is good, happiness is good, knowledge and freedom and intelligence and beauty are good, and this does not change for arbitrarily large amounts of life and beauty. Transhumanism is not a philosophy with a special adoration of technology. It's just a philosophy which says that technology is a normal way of achieving our aspirations. And this does not change even when you are talking about arbitrarily advanced technology. Biotech, nanotech, whatever, there's nothing exciting about it. It's just an ordinary part of the natural universe. The question then becomes, what beautiful and worthwhile occupations can you find to fill the next million years? This question, of course, is the province of fun theory. Fun theory is the branch of science, or rather wild speculation, that we use to answer questions such as, how much fun is there in the universe? Will we ever run out of fun? Are we having fun yet? And could we be having more fun? Is fun scalable? Does it require an exponentially greater amount of computation to support a linear increase in fun? I'm not going to present a rigorous theory of fun. This presentation is too short to present a rigorous theory of fun. They only give you 20 minutes. Very unfair. Also, I don't have a rigorous theory of fun. So instead, let's look at some things that are fun. For example, why is being in love fun? This question was recently answered when scientists discovered that being in love stimulates the same brain centers that are stimulated by eating chocolate. So this would be one possible answer to the question of what is fun. We could say that fun involves a certain kind of brain chemistry. I do not think this is a good answer. Or if you select this as an answer, then you are leaving out something important, whether or not you call it fun. Why? Well, suppose we ran a little wire into one of the brain's pleasure centers and hooked the wire up to a button and gave you that button, and you spent the next million years pressing that button. Just that, doing nothing else. I consider this to be a highly dystopian scenario, a sterile dead end. Seems more like counterfeit fun than a genuine article. Having your pleasure centers artificially stimulated, wireheading, as Larry Niven called it, is not philosophically acceptable fun. That's what we're looking for, not just fun, however we end up defining that, but philosophically acceptable fun. To have good, clean fun, or even wicked, dirty fun, it seems like you need to be doing something and getting somewhere. What about eating cookies? Why do we eat cookies? Certainly not because we're hungry. We eat cookies because 50,000 years ago, before the invention of agriculture, sugar and fat were the limiting resources. So we evolved to prefer sugar and fat, and we still prefer sugar and fat today in modern times when people are dying from too many calories instead of too few because evolution has not had time to catch up. So our fun activities, just those activities that your ancestors performed, the way that men watch football games because it involves competing tribes throwing things at each other, is personal fulfillment to be found in harmony with your ancestral environment. It would explain why modern-day jobs, such as accounting, have the annoying property of draining people's life force. Of course, this will only remain true of humans who retain their ancestral neurology. If 21st-century civilization stayed around for a couple of million years, humans would eventually evolve to find personal fulfillment in doing their income tax forms. This also strikes me as dystopian. Although it is less dystopian than eating Pringles and watching football. Okay, what about the Rubik's Cube? Why is solving the Rubik's Cube fun? It's not an ancestral activity, does not directly mess with your brain chemistry, doesn't deliver any kind of sensual reward when you finish solving it, Why do we find it fun? It's not a competitive game, even. It's just pure math. It's group theory embodied in a physical cube. And we, as humans, can have fun playing with that. It's something to be proud of. But the Rubik's Cube contains only a limited amount of fun. You use it up, and then it's gone. At first, solving the cube is fun, then it's boring. What changes? Does the cube itself change? Do they ship Rubik's Cubes from the factory containing only a limited amount of fun, so you have to buy a new one every 3 months? No, the cube is a mathematical concept, and it is eternal. The cube does not change. You change. The person who finishes solving the cube is not the same person who started it. The person who picked up the cube for the first time may have known nothing about this class of puzzle, or have not yet discovered the idea of transformations that move only a few cubes around and leave the rest constant. When you finish the Rubik's Cube, you have not only learned something about the cube, you have learned something about how to solve this kind of problem. You even have learned something about learning. Once you have learned what the cube has to teach you, solving the cube becomes easy. So easy that it isn't fun anymore. In having fun with the cube, you outgrow it, and outgrowing the cube is part of the fun. What do you do when you've outgrown the cube? Well, you can find online a Java applet that implements a fourth-dimensional version of the Rubik's Cube, a Rubik's Tesseract. I do not understand this puzzle. I am still trying to figure out how the pieces move. If I had not already learned the principles involved in the Rubik's Cube, the Rubik's Tesseract would be completely incomprehensible. So you solve one problem, outgrow it, and then that gives you the abilities to move on to the next problem. And when you've solved every possible form the Rubik's Cube can take, generalized on a level where the entire class of problems becomes uninteresting, then what? Then you move on to the next class of problems at a higher level of complexity. This is a key ingredient of fun. It's not quite the only ingredient of fun, but it's the key ingredient. But it's a key ingredient, and it's the only one I have time to cover here. Novel complexity. Complexity you have not yet encountered. The smarter you are, the faster you generalize, and the faster you become bored with any given problem. Yes, the smarter you are, the faster you get bored. That is how it works. But when you get smarter, you can perceive new areas of the problem space that would have been incomprehensible to you before. Humans would get bored with chimpanzee fun extremely fast, but the space of human fun is enormously larger than the space of chimpanzee fun. If you have 10 bits, you have 1,000 possibilities. If you have 20 bits, you have 1,000,000 possibilities. If you have 30 bits, you have 1,000,000,000 possibilities. I don't think fun quite goes exactly like that. I don't think it's quite that simple, but I think that the basic relation is the same, that the size of fun space grows roughly exponentially as the amount of intelligence, that the more variables you have in your mind, larger the problems you solve. As the problems get larger, the space of possible novel problems goes up exponentially. Or not. It is only a conjecture. But at any rate, the idea that we're going to get smart and then instantly run out of fun is based, I think, first on the stereotype of rich people who get bored, and secondly, on the idea that you're limited to human fun, and that the smarter you are, the faster you'll get bored with human fun. This is true. The smarter you are, the faster you'll get bored with human fun. But when you get the very act of getting bored with human fun, that this is no longer novel complexity, means you're ready to move on. So there is an immense amount of fun out there to be had. Even for humans, the size of human fun space is so large that no one individual could possibly succeed in experiencing all the possible kinds of human fun, though I encourage you to try. One person cannot fulfill more than a tiny infinitesimal fraction of the human space of possibilities. Why? Because one person's lifespan is too short? Of course not. I plan to still be alive after the last star in the Milky Way is dead. But even if you live forever, you will not be able to explore more than a tiny fraction of human fun space before you outgrow it. And that, of course, is the scary part, growing up. Right now, we are each of us growing old. Not growing up, growing old. We are actually losing neurons as we grow old, instead of adding new capacity. We lose vitality, creativity, flexibility, energy, even personal health as we age. This is not a feature. This is a bug. It is a very unnatural thing to lose neurons as you age. You should be adding on more neurons as we grow up, to hold more and more experiences and more complex skills. To shrink as we age borders on the perverted. This is not the way things are supposed to be. And at some point, we shall have to do a little rearranging. Once that bug is fixed, however, once we are truly growing up instead of growing old, there will be only so much time you can remain human. If every day you learn something new, there will come a time, after a sufficiently large number of days, when you have learned so much that you can pick up a Rubik's Tesseract and see it as a small, trivial thing to be solved with a few flicks, cast aside. And if that prospect does not scare you, you must have a very well-integrated personality. This leads us to the fear of growing up. The fear of growing up is the third major cause of the fear of living forever, after the repressed fear of death and the fear of boredom. In our time, the fear of growing up is actually a minor academic fad, except that it is not called the fear of growing up. It is called the fear of post-humanity. The funny thing is that transhumanists were using the word post-human long before folks like Francis Fukuyama tried to make it into a scare word. We were not particularly scared by the word post-human, even though we were way back in the good old days. We were using the word post-human to indicate people who had grown up into Jupiter brains. That is, people whose minds had become so large that they had to run themselves on computers the size of Jupiter. This, roughly speaking, is what the old-time transhumanists meant by post-human. Francis Fukuyama seems to use the term post-human to indicate someone with a couple of minor genetic hacks, which by our standards is such a tiny alteration as to not be worth noticing. And yet, Fukuyama is scared of his post-humans. What wonders what he would think of ours? He would probably catch fire and die. Not every change is an improvement, but every improvement is necessarily a change. To move forward, you must move. Are you ashamed to be a post-child or a post-chimpanzee? When Fukuyama reinvented the word post-human, he imbued it with an intellectual sleight of hand, the good old naturalistic fallacy that is implies ought. Human nature is an evolved mix of light and darkness. Hitler was not an inhuman monster. He was a human monster. The Library of Alexandria was built and burned by one and the same species. Only by judging myself, by not being content to rest where I am, can I move forward. These rules are not suspended when I judge parts of myself that are a part of universal human nature. Here again, it is transhumanism that is the simpler case. Transhumanism as a philosophy contains no special exemption from moral judgment for evils that are embedded in human nature. I am not going to stop debugging myself when I run across bugs that are part of human nature. I guess that makes me a post-humanist. Not every change is an improvement, but every improvement is necessarily a change. Not every form of post-humanity is a nice place to live, but all sufficiently nice places to live are necessarily post-human. Let's make the future a nice place to live.
That was a talk by Eliezer Yudkowsky, the research scientist who works at the Singularity Institute for Artificial Intelligence. He's also a board member of the World Transhumanist Association. And he delivered that talk at the Transvision Conference on Transhumanist Bioethics, which I organized at Yale University. The date of that talk was June 28, 2003. Stay tuned for my little witty riposte to Margaret Somerville about gay marriage. The following is one of my biweekly change surfing columns from Better Humans Magazine and Transhumanity Magazine, which is on the topic of beyond gay marriage. And it starts, "This August, Better Humans has arranged for me to debate Margaret Somerville in Toronto. Somerville is a bioethicist at Montreal's McGill University who is opposed to assisted suicide, using transgenic transplant organs, cloning, and a long list of other things that she deems offensive to human dignity. Somerville has also decided this month to paddle upstream in opposition to Canada's legalization of gay marriage with an open letter to the gay New Democratic Party MP, Sven Robinson. In the interest of full disclosure, I should say that I once hosted Sven Robinson in the U.S. at a meeting of the Democratic Socialists of America, the New Democratic Party's American sister party, that I marched many times with a fist and rose banner in Chicago's Gay Pride Parade, and that although today married to a woman, I have a sexual self-identity that is so bent it may not be mappable onto Euclidean space. Despite these compromising and entangling alliances, well, it sounds kind of hot when I put it that way, I would like to comment on Somerville's defense of heterosexist marriage for two reasons. First, her letter succinctly sums up what is wrong with conservative bioethics. One, the idolatry of the natural over the reasonable. And second, it gives me an opportunity to cruise past the gay marriage debate, which is so last week, and advocate one of my favorite utopian ideas, replacing state marriage with flexible cohabitation and child-rearing contracts. Let's start with Somerville's letter. She says that the reason that we shouldn't permit gay marriage is that social features, quote, are open to change, inherent natural ones are not. Marriage, like many important social institutions, is a combination of natural reality, that is, the biology of procreation, and social construct, the culture that nurtures and supports procreation. In other words, though Somerville is far too suave to phrase it this way, homosexual relationships are unnatural. Somerville makes clear that she is not a simple homophobe in her book, The Ethical Canary, because she says there that it's okay for kids to be raised by gay parents as long as the household includes both a lesbian couple and a gay male couple, because having both a father and a mother is what nature intended and what is good for the child. Not what God intended. No, she can't say that because the G word is not appropriate in the realm of secular ethical discourse, but for her, what is natural. It's a wonderfully ahistorical argument, since all simian and anthropological evidence suggests, in fact, that what is natural for our species is for men to beat each other up, establish a dominance hierarchy, and take ownership of as many women as they can possibly control. The majority of all documented human cultures practice polygamy. What's natural for women, it appears, is to try to have as many liaisons with attractive males who are not their owner as possible, to maximize their kids' genetic fitness, and to reduce the risks of outside males killing her kids by making the paternity of those kids ambiguous. In the natural order, all this would take place in a village social structure in which kids are in fact raised by a dozen or more people of all genders, including older siblings and cousins. All this monogamous, nuclear family, death till we part heterosexist stuff is recent flummery, forced on us by culture and religion, and is about as natural as monastic celibacy, flush toilets, and reading. So Somerville and other would-be natural law theorists in conservative bioethics and jurisprudence are just making up their own version of nature as they go along. Nature is whatever they happen to favor, and not the tendencies to violence, depravity, and licentiousness, or cultural creativity, rational free thought, and so on, which they find troublesome. If anybody cares about what the true biological constraints are on human nature, it's we humanists and transhumanists, since, as Peter Singer has pointed out recently in A Darwinian Left, we have to acknowledge those constraints if we are to overcome them and create a truly human civilization. Somerville suggests in her letter that the role of, or at least the assumption of, marital fidelity is to cement parents' sociobiological drive to nurture and to raise their little gene machines. Therefore, we need to maintain the system of heterosexist marriage and not screw it up with reproductive technologies and gay marriage, or else kids will go hungry in the streets. How offensively crude and silly a statement of the naturalistic fallacy that the is dictates the ought, and how absurd a view of human nature. Adoption also has deep sociobiological roots, and studies show that the children of gay parents and children born from donated sperm and eggs are just as loved as natural children. And who really cares what our genes want and what messages they whisper in our brains? Our genes also want us dead, and I don't think we're obliged to listen to that either. The real task here is to build a society that maximizes the full potential of the personalities of its citizens, not a society that builds some ludicrous cargo cult totem to a mythical natural order. Human institutions are meant to serve human needs and interests, so why does the state get involved in marriage in the first place? Somerville says, quote, society needs marriage to institutionalize the inherently procreative relationship between a man and a woman. Wrong. We need state recognition of marriages because people who live together become intimately dependent on one another, and we need to recognize, protect, and manage those dependencies. Families are a different kind of social unit than individuals, and things work best when families are granted certain rights and privileges and responsibilities. So we need to have rules about what families are. Children, in particular, are best served and thrive when raised by families, and their care needs to be managed by a binding contractual arrangement among the people in those families to protect their interests and those of the caregivers. Human interests and relationships need protection, not procreation. The human race would keep procreating without legal ties just fine, and did for quite a long time. So let's replace marriage with civil union contracts. Those contracts can have adaptable clauses. With software, we could write them with push-button menus, so that every 2 to 5 people who want to enter into a cohabitation or child-rearing contract could specify ahead of time exactly what they were agreeing to. My aunt once told me that she was astonished that my wife and I had not only lived together for 8 years before getting married, but that we had talked everything to death. She said she never talked about anything with her husband until after she was married. My aunt died with that husband, but can't we all agree that it would be a good idea for everybody to have a good, long, hard talk about it, what exactly they mean by marriage before they tie the knot? For instance, is infidelity a definite contract breaker? Somerville says marriage between one man and one woman symbolizes sexual monogamy. The same is not necessarily true of same-sex marriage, unquote. She scolds the gays often discussed whether monogamy will be an expected part of their relationship. That just means that queers are smarter and more honest than straight people, and a lot less likely to end up on Jerry Springer throwing chairs. People should be clear if a drug habit, or a sudden veganism, or Atkinsism, or refusing to turn out the light at a reasonable time of night are grounds for abrogation of a marriage contract. Must the kids be baptized, and can Dad 2 and Mom 1 take them to the local coven's full moon bacchanals? How many warnings do I get about leaving dirty pots in the sink, and is there binding arbitration in case we have an argument? Canada, I salute you. By legalizing gay marriage, while the U.S. Supreme Court gets death threats for just saying that sodomy shouldn't be a felony, you and the rest of the industrialized world show that there is still hope for humanism and liberal democracy. Now, while we try to catch up in the States, you and Europe need to take the next step and recognize that the state has no business dictating how many people should be allowed into these contracts and what they should entail. We must carry the rational human design of human institutions to its conclusion, despite the frenzied opposition of those to whom nature or God have revealed the way that things are supposed to be. Yeah, well, gay marriage is one thing, they'll probably say in a couple years, but them there polyamorous child-rearing contracts, them just ain't natural. Right. That's what makes them human. To read more of the Change Surfing columns that I've published over the last year, go to betterhumans.com. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the A-Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.